Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If your kids have outgrown or worn out their old clothes, imagine if you didn't have money for new ones or the fabric to make them. Where would you turn? In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, many resourceful people turned to the cloth sacks that carried flour, animal feed, and many other things. This hour, the history of feed sacks as a source of fabric. With me today is Lindsay McCray. She is the author of Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of a Frugal Fabric. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you live in Iowa City, and feed sacks as fabric is probably, if people have grown up in Iowa, if they are the product of generations of people who lived in Iowa, they may have heard about this before. But when did you first, you grew up in California, when did you first encounter the idea of people using feed sacks as a source of fabric?
Well, I'm a quilter, and I belong to the Old Capitol Quilters Guild. And in, I think it was 2010, Mike Zaz, who you probably know from the Brinton Film Project from Washington, Iowa, came and gave a talk. And in addition to the films, he has an amazing feed sack collection. And I just was blown away. I couldn't believe it. And I'm a freelance writer in addition to, at that time, working for the university as a writer and editor. And I just started writing stories about them. And I was blogging for Etsy. And I wrote a story for Etsy and about feed sacks, and it got over 200 comments. And I suddenly realized, oh, I'm not the only one who's amazed by this story. So that was the beginning for me.
Well, before we get into really how amazing this story is, let's talk about the nuts and bolts of feed sacks. Because a long, long time ago, of course, manufacturing sacks for sending feed wouldn't have been practical. So feed was sent in barrels or crates?
Barrels or kegs. Were used, and they were, you know, functional, but they were just even empty. They were very heavy. They were awkward. They took up a lot of floor space to store. So once it became feasible to sew feed sacks tightly enough to have them held closed when the lock stitch sewing machine came into being in the mid-1840s, then the move from barrels to feed sacks happened.
All right. So really the sewing machine was the thing that started this revolution.
That's right.
And pretty much everything could be put in a sack at that point, right?
Everything could be and everything was. And it's really interesting how many things were delivered in sacks. Mike Zaz, I know, had a giant sack for laxatives, you know. But certainly all of the traditional things that you think of, sugar, flour, animal feed, animal seed, fertilizer, and really just about everything was delivered in sacks. I was just showing Charity a sack that had auto parts were shipped in. So,
right,
yeah.
Which seems like a very unusual thing to ship in a sack. So these early sacks that were sent out, I can imagine that on a farm where you need to have animal feed, you need to have seed, you need to have flour, you need to have, you know, all of these staples. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that where there may not have been money for much else, there would have been an accumulation of empty feed sacks.
Exactly. And I think that women picked up on this very quickly. And I do want to say that I talk about women as the people who sewed with the sacks, but that is typically who was doing it. So it was seen as sort of, and I'm putting this in quotes, free fabric. And these early sacks were plain. They would have the logo maybe stamped on them, but, you know, women could use them for all kinds of things, and they did. And then after maybe they had been curtains or dish towels, they often found their way into the barn and were used as rags for cleaning up. So nothing really went to waste, and those sacks were just kind of a real bonanza for people who didn't have a lot of resources.
And you share some apocryphal stories of if the wind blew, then you would see the logo of a certain flower company or seed company on someone's bloomers.
Exactly. And one of the more famous stories is the woman who didn't remove the self-rising flower label from her husband's underwear. So, you know, there are those famous stories. But and often people would, if getting the logos out was hard. It was very tough work, and there are all sorts of formulas that people used of soap and lye and bleach. And
right. So they had this fabric, but it had stuff on it. So,
right.
Of course, if you wanted to turn it into clothing, people tried to get that off.
Right.
And you print columns and columns of household hints to try to get these logos off the fabric.
Exactly.
And it sounds like the kind of thing that would really tear up your skin and
yes.
make a terrible smell.
Yeah. And I think it was so hard to do that if you didn't have to, and that's why people's underwear had the logo still on it, because they just wouldn't bother, you know, if it wasn't going to show, that they wouldn't bother. Because you're right, it was very challenging to get those logos off.
All right. So immediately women were using this fabric because it was there. So they were using it for things that they needed it for. And whether that was dish towels or whether that was clothing, they were going to use it, especially during a time of scarcity if they didn't have anything else. But there became this relationship over time between the companies that made the bags and those women. And so the intermediary, of course, is the feed company or the flour company. When the bag companies started realizing that people were using their fabric, they started trying to make it better, right?
Right. And actually, it was the bag manufacturers that were trying to make it better, and the National Cotton Council. And there were all kinds of partnerships of people working together. But one of the first things that happened was that they did figure out a way to make washout inks, so that you could get the inks out more easily, and they would stamp right on the bag the directions for getting that ink out. And then the next thing that came along was that they started to as a value added, they would put embroidery patterns, or they would put actual dolls that you could cut out and stuff and sew and have a little doll. And they would print those right on the bags to make them more valuable to the consumer. And one of my favorite examples is days of the week towels, where, you know, if the wife had Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, she would say to her husband, go back and get me Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it was a really interesting example of marketing and marketing to women and realizing that women held, even though they didn't have the income necessarily or the salary, they held a lot of they made a lot of the decisions about where a family's money was spent.
Well, I think it's so interesting because it's certainly an early example of a strong understanding of consumer psychology.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really fascinated by that as well. So
as you went back and started looking into this, I mean, one of the things that really struck me from reading about it, I knew that this had happened, but in my mind, it happened so long ago, but really this was going on much more recently than
yes.
I imagined. So give me kind of a timeline. I mean, the Great Depression was a time when, of course, there was a great deal of scarcity. So you used whatever you had. So that was certainly a time when a lot of people were using these feed sacks.
Right, right. And the Depression was a time. So in the evolution of feed sacks, there's sort of the plain sacks and then the sacks with the logos and then the sacks with the embroidery patterns. And the and then in 1927, I think it was, someone started something called gingham girl flour. And they came up with the idea of having sacks printed out of red and white gingham. And there are examples through those late 20s, early 30s of printed sacks, but somehow they never caught on. And it wasn't until the late 30s that and Percy Kent Company is credited with figuring out, let's do dress prints. Let's make our feed sacks out of dress prints. And that was just a whole revolution. And all of the feed sack companies started doing that.
I would think that that would be a lot more expensive for the company to do, though. What were the economics of that?
It was somewhat more expensive, but the overall difference was, I think they said a plain sack was maybe 7 cents. Worth about 7 cents, and a printed sack about 25 cents. So it did add, but it wasn't a tremendous amount. And the value of, you know, what you got for it was really worthwhile for many rural women who often didn't get into town or didn't have an opportunity to shop for fabric or couldn't afford to shop for fabric.
So it created brand loyalty in a really unique way.
Very much so, yeah. And then in terms of the evolution of it, the Depression was important. But what really, when it really hit its peak, was World War II. And that was because the feed sack manufacturers very cleverly had their bags labeled as for industrial use. And so they were able to still sell them with cotton, whereas most of the rest of the cotton and other fibers went to the war effort. So you couldn't really buy fabric off the bolt then. And there was there's a statistic that I think it's in 1945 that there were 3 million men, women, and children wearing clothing made of feed sacks in the United States. And it happened all over the United States. And And in the 50s, they continued to be somewhat popular, but it started waning as women had other opportunities for work and there was less sewing and they could buy store-bought clothing more easily. And the last feed sacks were probably printed in the early 1963-64.
And give me an idea of how big this was. I mean, you brought in a stack of feed sacks today, and I see, you know, maybe 8 different patterns. Your book is full of hundreds mm-hmm. of different patterns. Mm-hmm. This was huge.
It was huge. And we have 900 different images, more than 900 images in the book of feed sacks. There were thousands and thousands printed. And there's a woman in Florida, Pat Reed, who started a collection of swatches. And she has in that book 18,000 different prints or colorways of those prints. And I said, well, were there more? And her daughter said, we just stopped counting at 18,000. So no one knows the exact number.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and as you were starting to do this research and looking into these prints, I mean, so much of this fabric was used and used mm-hmm. in quilts and used in clothing. How did you identify it as feed sack fabric?
That's a really good question. And, of course, the easiest way to identify it is if it's still sewn into a sack, which
right.
you can still find. And also, there you can tell if the fabric is not still sewn in a sack, you can often see the little stitching holes along the edges. They don't tend to fade because the thread was pretty thick that they used. So that's one way to tell. With clothing, it's much more difficult. Sometimes very frugal women would use that little line of stitching and hide it in the seam. But what I'm finding more and more is that it's just a matter of recognizing the prints. And I find that people who are real experts can look at a quilt and say, oh, that's feed sack, that's feed sack, that's not.
Because they've seen the print before, or because there's something about the print that tells them?
It's often because they've seen it before, but I do think there's a sort of a weave that you can sometimes tell is feed sack. On the other hand, there are multiple weaves. I mean, feed sacks were not just all plain weaves, so.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Lindsay McRae. She is the author of Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of a Frugal Fabric. And if this is part of your family history, we would love to hear from you. We want to hear your stories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the history of feed sacks as a source of fabric. This was a very common source of fabric in our history from the late 19th century all the way through the 1950s, even into the early 1960s. With me right now is Lindsay Cole McRae of Iowa City. She is the author of Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of a Frugal Fabric. We're going to bring a collector into the conversation here in just a moment. But first, I want to go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Helen is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Helen. Hi, Helen. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much for calling. So sewing with this fabric is a part of your history, right?
Oh, yes. When I was 10 years old in 1945, my feed sack dress won a blue ribbon at the fair in Bloomington, Wisconsin.
Wow.
And I still have the dress. I just never got rid of it. It was kind of cute. It had a drawstring in the neck and on the sleeves, and it was a cute dress. So,
uh-huh.
And
Helen, when it won that award at the fair, was it a competition to see who could make something out of feed sacks?
No. I didn't have to use feed sacks. It was my 4-H project.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful. And, it turned out really well.
Yes. The feed sack material, the big thing you had to do was pull a thread and get a straight line, because often the feed sacks were not, they weren't necessarily straight. And so if you had to cut too much off, you lost material.
Oh,
the
I
material
never thought
would be
of that.
About a yard square. But if it was crooked, and they often were crooked, they were crooked more than that. They didn't straighten them out necessarily when they did them. So,
what was the fabric?
what was the fabric?
Yeah.
Mine, the one I used was a blue print. And I actually have some feed sacks. I didn't have any left, but my aunt, when she died at 102 and we were cleaning out her things, she had some that had never been used.
Uh-huh.
And so I have a couple dozen of them. But the big thing was to get enough of one pattern I had enough of this pattern to make this dress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of stories I've heard of people sending their husbands back to the feed store with a swatch to match.
the other thing that I was going to mention, I thought maybe you would have mentioned it, but was at the Hoover Library. I don't think the sacks are on display anymore because they were too fragile. But because Hoover had given, a couple million dollars to save starving children in Europe, and then in return they sent seed sacks back.
Right. Beautifully embroidered. Yeah.
Yes. Had you ever that they were, but I don't think they're on display anymore.
I did go to West Branch and talk to Marcus Eckert, who's the curator there, and I have some pictures of a few of them in the book. And they are beautiful. And usually there are one or two on display there, but they have 400 in their collection.
Yeah. So. Well, and Helen, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And I've certainly seen some of those beautiful feed sacks sent as thank yous to President Hoover. Of course, that was before he was president when he led the Belgian relief. You can join our conversation with your stories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. One more call here. Nadine is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Nadine.
Hi there.
And you also used feed sacks for clothing.
Yes,
right?
I had three toddlers in the 50s, and one boy and two girls. And I made their summer shorts. And my girl's little dresses. And the lady preceding me was correct. Sometimes you had to get the same pattern, you had to get more than go back and see if you could find it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had heard that children's clothes were popular because you often only needed one sack to make them. Yeah.
Yeah. And then as they grew, because I really enjoyed them. They were, I lived next door to a hatchery, and that's why I was able to get so many of them.
Uh-huh.
And then I also made the little dolls for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And sent them as gifts to my nieces and nephews. Anyhow, that's my story.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, Nadine, thank you so much for calling. And Nadine mentioned living next door to a hatchery. This became part of the economics of feed sacks, too. Let's say a woman lived on a farm or worked, their family ran a hatchery. They would have so many extra feed sacks that she could sell them, right?
That's right. And often, for some reason, I guess because chickens are small, it was seen that women could be in charge of the chickens. And so it was one way that women actually could have an income by selling those extra sacks.
I want to bring Loretta Smith Steele into the conversation now. She is a quilter and a feed sack collector who lives in West Virginia. Many of her beautiful feed sacks are featured in your book, Lindsay. Hello, Loretta.
Hello.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And Loretta, how did you get into collecting feed sacks?
Well, as a child, as the other lady said, I wore lots of clothes made from them, and we also had other items around the home. My brothers had shirts made out of them. I remember my mother had a tablecloth that had the state of Alaska on it, which my brother was stationed there in the Air Force. So we had many varieties. My mother made most of our clothes. She was a very good seamstress. And everything that I remember wearing as a child was a feed sack, but it was gorgeous. I was very proud of what I was wearing. And I wore them up until the time that I went to work outside the home. So,
well, and I know that you are a quilter, and feed sacks make their appearance in many quilts. What made them, in your mind, particularly good for quilting?
Well, they're soft. They're easy to hand piece and easy to quilt. They have a little looser weave than the regular fabrics that we buy today. And I do have a collection of about 350. Mm-hmm. And I share, I trade patches with people, like 6-inch squares with other quilters that are on Facebook, not on Facebook, but on other places that you can learn about feed sacks. And I enjoy that very much. I just got to 9 the other day from an old friend. They were her mother's, mm-hmm. and she'd never used them. So I took them off her hands.
And the looking for feed sacks today, I mean, trading and collecting, where do you find them?
You find them at flea markets, at estate sales. We have an antique section in our town, several antique stores, and some of those dealers find them for me. I'm always looking. I'm always looking.
How long have you been collecting?
I've been collecting about 30 years. When my mother died, there was a small cardboard box with many little scraps in it, because she never threw anything away. You might need it. And she had two or three whole feed sacks alike. Well, I'm still using pieces of those. I've used up every little scrap in quilts. I've made several quilts. My children have them. My granddaughter, when she got married, requested a double wedding ring made out of feed sacks, and that's exactly what she got. Mm. It's hand-pieced and hand-quilted.
And Loretta's won awards for her quilts also, wow. Right, Loretta?
Yes, I have.
Well, you mentioned the double wedding ring, which is a really intricate pattern, and it has a lot of really small pieces. And Lindsay, you write about this in the book, that perhaps the source of fabric was what drove some of these incredibly intricate patterns, because the women only had small scraps.
Right. That was one of the thoughts, because the double wedding ring, postage stamp quilts, tiny, tiny piece quilts were very popular in the 30s and 40s. But I talked to Carolyn Ducey, who's a curator at the International Quilt Study Center and Museum in Lincoln, and she had another theory, which was very funny, which she said she thought really it had to do as much with the fact that quilters are competitive as anything else, because she said there would often be newspaper stories about Mrs. Smith made this quilt and it had 3,762 pieces, and Mrs. Jones needed to make a quilt that had more. And so that was why there were so many small pieced quilts, but we don't know for sure.
Well, and the feed sacks weren't just used in the patterns of the quilts. I mean, the ones that did have patterns were used, but also the plain feed sacks, or the ones with the logos on them, could be incorporated into a quilt in a way that you couldn't see. You still can find that, right?
Right, right. They were often, if you were doing something called foundation piecing, where you're using silks or fabrics that fray easily, you might stitch them to one of those feed sacks, which you wouldn't see the logo. Or sometimes they were just used on the back of a quilt. And often people would try and get those logos out, but they weren't always successful. And, of course, they would not like that. But today, if we found a quilt that you could see the logo on it, we would be very excited and think it was very collectible. So.
Well, Loretta, at this point in history, finding feed sacks to use in your quilt seems like harder work than just going to the fabric store. Why is it something that still appeals to you to use this fabric in your quilting?
Well, because they remind me of my childhood. I loved wearing them. I remember going to the store with my mother, and it took 3 feed sacks to make her a shirt waist dressed. She would, if he had 3 bags of feed there, she would buy one, he'd put her name on the other two, and then she could buy them when we needed the feed. And then she had enough to make her a feed sack dress, and probably enough left to make other little items for us. We wore little halter tops that took very little fabric, but I wore those for years
and
during the summer.
For you, you felt really proud of these clothes. Lindsay, you also write about other people who don't have fond memories of wearing these feed sack fabrics. I mean, this for some people, this was a marker of poverty.
For some people, it was. And I had heard that. But really and truly, of the many, many people I interviewed, most people had fond memories of it. I sometimes think that's because their mother was doing all the work. And they have fond memories of their mother. But
yeah.
But I also think that, you know, it brings up a time. It reminds them of a time, like Loretta says, of her childhood, you know, and good memories. So, but yeah, some people did consider it a sign of poverty. And once they were able to not afford to sew or to buy ready-made clothes with, you know, not with feed sacks, they did that immediately and got rid of their feed sack clothing.
Well, and Loretta, I am struck looking at the beautiful, beautiful pictures in Lindsay's book, but also in that she brought in a stack of feed sacks today. These patterns are really lovely. I mean, I could imagine going to a fabric store and buying these patterns. I mean, was that part of the excitement, part of the fun, that maybe you didn't get to fully select what your clothes would look like, but then you would find this treasure? There's a pattern that you just loved.
Well, my mother always, she was a seamstress and an excellent seamstress. And if we got a feed sack, I remember my Easter dress one year was pink. And I have found that exact feed sack, and I keep it because it reminds me of that dress that I had when I was 12 or 13 years old.
What are your favorites, Loretta? Is there in collecting feed sacks, is there something specifically that you're looking for?
No, I like a variety because I make a lot of quilts. I'm trying to think of the name of the quilt, Drunkard's Path. It's a very good one to piece out of feed sacks. And I've made several versions because you can turn the pieces several ways. And there again, the give, it's a curved piece, so there again, the give in the feed sack makes it excellent to piece quilts with.
The give in the feed sack?
In the fabric.
Okay, because it was a looser weave,
mm-hmm. right,
which was less expensive for the company to manufacture.
Right.
Well, it's not less expensive now.
No.
I mean, the most I ever pay is $15 for one, and I think that's reasonable.
I think that's pretty good, Loretta, because I'm going to admit I've paid more than one that for one.
Are they getting a lot harder to find, Loretta?
Yeah, they are, but then I run onto people like I did Saturday. I went to the cemetery to pay tribute to my parents and my husband, and the lady who takes care of it, she's the one that I bought the 9 feed sacks off of because she had them put back. They were her mother's, and I don't think she would have sold them to anybody but me because she knows me.
Right, so, the sentimental attachment to those and the fact that she knows that they'll be used. Now, you mentioned that pink feed sack that you have set aside. There are many feed sack collectors now who don't use the fabric, who just collect them as is. Is it important to you to use this fabric?
Yes. Yes, it is. I'm making a quilt right now that has 5.5-inch squares, and each square is different. Mm. And there's 102, I think, in the quilt.
Mm. It'll be beautiful.
I like them with everyone is different, yes. Mm-hmm. And the sashing will really set it off. The sashing is not feed sack, but it will set off the colors in the feed sacks.
Nice. Well, Loretta, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
Loretta Smith Steele is a quilter and a feed sack collector who lives in West Virginia. There are a lot of people who want to join this conversation. I want to go to Marie in Iowa City. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Yeah, you're a quilter?
No, I'm a 90-year-old nun, and I have my mother made a quilt out of all the scraps of the clothes that she made for us through the years. So I sleep under that quilt every night, and I can see in there all the patterns of my sister's and my brother's clothes that my mother made. So anyway, I just wanted to recognize the fact that we used all everything over and over. And I can remember going to the feed store, and the man always said, "Why is it that the sack you want is always on the bottom of the pile?"
Oh, I'll bet that drove store owners crazy, because I'll bet it did happen all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, Marie.
For sure.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling.
Anyway, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Well, and Marie makes such a wonderful point, because it wasn't just people using feed sacks for quilts. It was people using feed sacks for clothes and then using that fabric for quilts.
Exactly. Exactly. Or clothes or curtains or, you know, anything in your home. And then the little scraps from making that might have wound up in your quilts. So,
or when someone outgrew that particular item of clothing.
Exactly.
When you're looking at these fabrics, is there a way to, can you be kind of an archaeologist and figure out the history of some of the pieces of fabric that make their way into quilts?
Yeah, you can. And I think part of that is based on the patterns. You know, the patterns changed over time, kind of in relation to what was popular in clothing and furniture patterns, upholstery patterns. So there maybe were smaller and sort of more sweet calicos early on. And then there's some prints that now you look at them and you think they're very modern and contemporary. And the prints tended to get larger as time went on. So that's one way that you can tell. But it's not always. You can't always tell.
Well, and it's interesting because, of course, a scrap of fabric could live in a rag bag for many years.
Exactly.
So there are pieces from different decades that
exactly.
make their way into different quilts.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Lindsay Cole McCrae. She is the author of Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of a Frugal Fabric. We're also going to talk about how home sewing has changed over time when we come back. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about feed sacks as a source of fabric. My guest is Lindsay Cole McCrae. She is the author of Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of a Frugal Fabric. In just a few minutes, we're also going to talk about how home sewing has changed over time. I want to take a couple more phone calls before we get to that topic, because a lot of people have had experience with sewing with feed sacks. Lynette is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Lynette. Oh, maybe Lynette has dropped off. We'll go to another call here in just a moment. But I want to ask you about the collections. Your book is so colorful. It's so full of these patterns. Where did you find all those feed sacks?
Well, it was a challenge. And my publisher had a few, but neither of us had an extensive collection. And finally, through a series of interviews, including one with a woman from Pleasant Hill, I learned about a woman in Palmyra, Nebraska, Gloria Hall. And Gloria and her grandson, Paul Pugsley, both have amazing feed sack collections. And they invited Janine, the publisher, Janine Van Gool of Uppercase, and I to come. And we spent two complete eight-hour days just photographing feed sacks. And their collection and her knowledge. Gloria was very generous with her knowledge, and she's a real expert. I am not. I am a journalist who wrote about feed sacks and
well,
learned something along the way.
But the book is stunningly beautiful and a feast for the eyes. So
thank you.
That's
really fun.
Yeah. Mary is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi. What's
thank
your
you
experience?
For getting me on.
Yeah. What's your experience with feed sacks?
Pretty much the same as a lot of them that you've had. The post Depression child mother that was a very good seamstress, and she would make our things. My brother had shirts, and I had everything I wore, and my sister's little fun dresses and pinafores, and she always had a way of making them decorative enough that you didn't know that that's what you were wearing.
Yeah.
And as she did use the flower sacks because it was a tighter weave.
Mm-hmm.
With every one of our dish towels were of the flower sacks.
Mm.
And then the feed sacks were from for our clothing. And she made her own house dresses out of that. And then, but I smiled when the lady said, "Why is the one you always want on the bottom?" Because my mom would do that. She'd go through and she'd pick these so many kinds, ones that she wanted for a bigger piece, and that experience was a part of our life as well.
Yeah.
When mom died, and we took her things away, we found several quilts that she had made, used kind of as a, well, I would call it a mattress pad, underneath everything on the bed. So I kept two of the quilts that she had made with feed sacks. And I donated one to the Cedar Falls Historical Society, and I still own one. They weren't fancy quilts like I've heard some of the ladies talking about. And I have, other than learning to sew with the
feed sacks. I have not made anything myself with them, and I don't collect them, but I would love to get hold of that book.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for calling and for sharing your story with us. I think that there's probably a lot of these treasures hidden away. A couple quick questions for you. This one is an email. I still have a stack of sturdy cotton chicken feed sacks, many colors and patterns, saved by my mom in the 1950s. I'd love to hear new ideas for their use. obviously, we've been talking a little bit about that today, but the question is, when does age finally take a toll on the fibers and their durability? So if you're holding on to this fabric, is there a concern?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I have not seen that they wear out. I mean, of course, any fabric will wear out. But the colors have remained so vibrant. One thing I have found in some of the ones I've gotten is that they have been stacked up for decades and they don't smell very good. And you can sunshine and fresh air do a lot. Hang them on the clothesline for a day. You can wash them. I mean, they are washable. But I have not really seen a problem, unless they've been used a lot, with the wear being an issue if you were going to start sewing with them.
Interesting. Now. Well, we've been talking a lot about a time when people had to make do with very little, but also a time when people sewed their own clothes for themselves and for their families. Home sewing has changed a lot over time. And Ellen McKinney is here with us now. She's an assistant professor of apparel, events, and hospitality at Iowa State University. Hello, Ellen.
Good morning.
Hi, Ellen.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I know that you've been doing some research along with one of your graduate students about home sewing over time. And we're talking about a time when, of course, you couldn't just go out to the store and buy something. And when it made economic sense to sew at home. When did things start to change? When did home sewing really start to disappear?
You know, I think in the 70s, we saw just the great availability of all kinds of ready-to-wear apparel in the stores, and the prices started to become a lot more reasonable. And so with more people, women especially, working outside the home, it just became to make more economic sense to buy your clothes rather than sew your own.
Well, and it was a bit of a rebellion too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, because as the feminist movement, you know, got rolling, women kind of rebelled against traditional home roles and doing crafts and went in other directions.
So the I think about just the many, many hours that a woman would have had to spend in taking care of her family, in sewing all of their clothes, in sewing all of her own clothes. I mean, it's not just the cost of the fabric. It was an incredibly time-intensive chore. So I can understand stepping away from that when there was a possibility. One of the interesting things that I've found every time I step foot in a fabric store today, I think, not only is it easier to buy clothes, but sewing your own clothes is a really expensive hobby these days, Ellen.
It is a really expensive hobby. You know, you just want to make a simple blouse. Well, that might be 3 yards of fabric at $15 a yard, and then you might pay another $10 for a pattern, and you might put another $10 into buttons. I mean, it can really add up to be, as you say, an expensive hobby.
Is there has been a movement in recent years of people trying to sew at home more. Of course, there have always been people who sew at home. But do you see evidence of this becoming more common or more popular again?
I do think it is slowly taking a turn. We're seeing the younger consumers in kind of that 30, 40-year-old range starting to take up home sewing. Because it is a hobby that they like to do, and they enjoy being able to control what they're wearing.
I think it's a very creative act also. I work one day a week at Home Ec Workshop, which is a small shop in Iowa City, I see lots and lots of young women come in. And it's something that's also very different from sitting in front of a computer, and you have a product at the end of it, and you can wear that product. So I think there's a creativity and kind of sometimes a relaxation, but it's not inexpensive. That's true.
Well, and even with quilting, Lindsay, you know, we're talking about reusing these pieces of fabric, and I know quilters, some quilters have rooms full
right.
of fabric they've collected over the years. But I mean, culturally, quilting can be extremely expensive as well because of all of the supplies. Is there a culture in quilting of reusing fabric still?
I think that's something that's really being addressed now and people are looking at again. And there are all kinds of people who are doing things with old clothing and, you know, maybe jeans or just different scraps. And I think that's part of it's interesting to me that this book has different audiences. It has audiences among 90-year-olds who remember wearing feed sack clothing or sewing with feed sacks. But there's also a whole group of younger women who are really inspired by the fabrics and colors and, you know, want to sew also or quilt and might be using scraps that they can find of things, too. So, and there's a big movement of scrap quilting among young women also.
Interesting. So. Well, and Ellen, when I think about how home sewing has changed, I mean, our skill sets have also changed as well. If I was going to make an outfit at home, not only would it would take me, you know, many, many more hours, but it wouldn't turn out nearly as well as something that I bought in a store. The erosion of these skills is another thing we've seen over time. And as you work with students who are maybe getting their hands dirty or at least, you know, spending time sewing things. Do you feel like people are still acquiring some of these skills?
Some of them are. A lot of the high schools today no longer offer the sewing education. And so we do have a good many students come to us that have no sewing experience. But, you know, at Iowa State University, we're certainly equipped to start them at ground zero and teach them everything they need to know. The home sewers, interestingly, really rely upon the internet and social media and communicating with one another and looking at YouTube and looking at blogs as their primary means of learning how to sew. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So that kind of cultural reservoir of this knowledge is available now. It used to be something you'd get from your mother and your grandmother mm-hmm. and your aunts and the other
right.
women in your community. But now that reservoir of knowledge is available again because of technology.
Exactly. It's an interesting turn of events.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from Colette. She said, my granddaughters still play with the feed sack doll clothes and doll quilt that my grandma made for me in the late 1940s and early 1950s. You mentioned the patterns on these feed sacks that would allow somebody to make dolls easily. Mm-hmm. But also, of course, a feed sack was a small one, maybe a sugar bag. That was just the right size to make doll clothes.
So, or a scrap. You know, a small scrap would be good for doll clothes. So, yeah.
You see a lot of those that have been preserved over time.
Yeah. Yeah. And children's clothing also. One of the callers mentioned, you know, they had kept a little dress. They're just so sweet and bring back those memories of childhood. So I think people do really hang on to those.
Here's an email from Mary in East Moline. I have photos of my mom, sister, me, and a doll dressed all in matching red, white, and blue stripes made from feed sack material made by my grandma in Baird, Iowa in 1953. We also actually still have one of the dresses.
Oh my
gosh. My grandpa was the old pioneer who sold Pioneer seed corn out of Coon Rapids. So grandma had many beautiful sacks to make clothing.
Oh, I would love to see that picture.
what a treasure. And you're finding that as you're talking to people about the book, that a lot of people have this as part of their heritage.
They do. And not just, you know, you think the Midwest. I thought the Midwest. But really all over the country, you find people who used and wore feed sacks. And they were part of their textile heritage in their home. So,
you said, Lindsay, that this is a kind of a therapeutic act, an act of creation, maybe, to sew at home. And Ellen, I'm curious, with the young people that you work with at Iowa State who want to do this now, who want to make their own clothes or clothes for other people, what do you think drives that?
You know, I really agree with what she said in the interviews my graduate student did with home sewers and young women home sewers in their 30s and 40s. It's really about creativity, about me time, and it is that having a product when you're done. Because if these people work outside of the home, many of them are in computer jobs, you know, and they don't have a physical object. And so it's such a wonderful thing to be able to sit down and make something and have something when you're done. And it's, I made it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So many of these items have been saved for so long. And Ellen, that makes me think about how different our culture is now. I mean, we mentioned that, of course, it's more expensive to sew your own clothes than it is to go out and buy clothes for the most part. And that's part of this fast fashion industry where we're buying things from overseas. So the workers aren't paid very much. We can get a garment for not a lot of money. But it also says something about how we don't hold on to things like we used to.
We don't. You know, I think that the mindset today is that a garment is almost a disposable item. You know, in the U.S. alone, there's 15 million tons of textile waste generated every year. So, yeah, people do not value their clothes the way they used to.
Do you have some things that I realize you don't sew your own clothes now, but do you have a few treasures that you've saved that have been sewn by hand?
You know, I have things that belong to my grandmother. I have a gorgeous pink wool boucle coat, and it has these great silver buttons on it that she made herself and wore it, and then it was passed down to me. So it's been around a long time, but it's beautifully made and I think a classic in fashion.
Nice. Well, and Lindsay, this interest in feed sacks, this interest in these fabrics, it does strike me as really a way of reaching into the past. And for many people, making that personal connection with their grandmothers or their great-grandmothers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. And talking about young women sewing, you often find that their mothers didn't know how to sew, but their grandmothers probably knew how to sew. So it is an interest. I think also the other thing that's kind of coming around is the sense of sustainability and that throwaway fashion is not a great thing. And the idea of, you know, making your own clothes, having scraps that you would make something out of. I think people are really understanding the importance of making things and keeping them. There are all kinds of movements, Ellen mentioned online, of, you know, people who have 7 or maybe more than that, 12 pieces of clothing, and they wear those. They make them themselves. They wear them in all different combinations, and people will follow their stories and try to emulate them because I think people understand it's not great to make things and throw or have clothing and throw it away.
Interesting. Well, and speaking of stepping outside of the world of fast acquisition, if people are looking for your book, they're not going to find it at large online booksellers.
They're
Where
not.
Can people find your book?
It's available at Prairie Lights. It's available at Home Ec Workshop in Iowa City and at Inspired to Sew in Cedar Rapids. And it's also available through uppercasemagazine.com, which is out of Calgary, Canada. But she ships from the United States. So.
All right. Well, it's Feed Sacks, The Colorful History of Frugal Fabric. Lindsay Cole McCray is the author. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Ellen McKinney.
Thank you.
Ellen McKinney, Assistant Professor of Apparel, Events, and Hospitality at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.